Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and home of over 1,000 entrepreneurs who come here to tell you their stories so that you can learn from them, build your success story, and then hopefully you'll come back here and tell others how you did it so you can pass it on to them. In this interview, we're going to hear the story of an entrepreneur who says he failed because he kept looking for good, cool ideas. Then things turned around for him when he decided to look to address people's pain. Once he addressed their pains, things worked out. His name is Brennan Dunn. He is the founder of, among other things, PlanScope, a project management tool built for consultants. I invited him here to talk about his experience. And the man who's paying me to do this interview is Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. I will tell you later why you should care about that and why he is the person to talk to. And why you should go to walkercorporatelaw.com when you're looking for a lawyer. First, I got to welcome Brennan. Thanks for being here.
How's it going, Andrew?
When you were building your business based on the cool model, do you have an example of a company or a product that you built?
Yeah, so I was consulting at the time. So I built stuff for other people for a living. And I had this great idea to build like an Airbnb but for food where, I mean, imagine I live in, you know, kind of in the suburbs. We don't really have good food, but we have these like, you know, we have an Indian family down the street, and I know they're cooking amazing, like, curries and everything, you know, out of their house. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if they could say, hey, I'm making this meal. I have 3 seats for sale. And you could just have a marketplace for homemade, really good, authentic food. Because the thing about where I am in southeastern Virginia, our international food is not really the best. But it's a very diverse, a lot of diverse people here. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if Airbnb meets homemade meals, right? And built it, got all obsessed with the code, with the with the glamour, I guess, of it, and it totally flopped.
Why do you think it flopped?
I think it flopped for a number of reasons. The first is marketplaces are just hard, right? Like it's hard to, you know, if you list, say somebody lists up a meal at their house and no one buys, they're not going to come back. And likewise, if somebody's hungry for Thai food and they can't find Thai food, they're not going to come back. So it's hard to kind of get that initial kind of like fit between both the provider and the consumer. But on top of that, you know, it's just a lot of things that I've learned that are really hard. Like it's a consumer app. It's really hard to, again, seed that marketplace. I would have needed a lot of funding, a lot of like marketing, like push behind it to really promote it. It just, for one person on the side, it was just impossible to do. So I, but it, you know, it sounded great on paper. It passed the whole friend that would be cool test. And
Did you find yourself imagining, well, I'm going to be like Brian and Joe and the Airbnb guys, and I'll have this thing that's worth a lot. You know, did you get yourself into that place?
Yeah. I mean, you can't help but be, you know, you hear these stories of these big, you know, you don't hear about the thousands of failures. So, yeah, I wanted something a little more predictable and reliable, and playing the startup lotto wasn't that for me.
That makes sense. All right. And the thing about you, though, is you're not, or you weren't at the time, a novice entrepreneur who didn't know what he was doing, and it still didn't work out for you. You're a guy who actually grew up in an entrepreneurial household, right? From an early age. What did your dad do?
So my dad, he owned a timeshare company.
You know what? As a kid, that was one of my fantasies, to sell timeshares, because you're selling $20,000 products to people who just came in because they want a free ticket and didn't even want the sales pitch.
He didn't sell timeshare. He bought or he resold timeshares from people who got scammed into buying it.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
If you bought a timeshare, but you're like, what the hell was I doing? Like, why did I do this? He'll take it off your plate and find a seller or a buyer for you.
And I guess he had companies that were buying it in bulk from him.
Did a lot of direct mail to, he bought lists of people who just bought timeshares, direct mailed them, had a sales team, did the whole, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was a very, very big thing.
Yeah, he really was. Do you remember one thing that you learned from him about sales or about direct sales via mail?
I mean, I learned a lot about like I used to think like these postcards are so cheesy. He would put this big smiley face on it, like this hand-drawn smiley face. And I'm like, this just looks like crap. Like who would, but it worked. Like he tested this over the years. And it's funny because a lot of the things I do online you know, are similar in a lot of ways, right? Like they have the same.
Give me an example of a smiley face that I on the outside would look at and go, what is Brennan doing? But Brennan knows what he's doing.
I think the long form sales letter was the hard thing for me when I started selling most of my products by having like paragraphs and paragraphs of information instead of the typical like, you know, shorter form stuff that we all like.
I get it.
But that don't work as well.
All right. And you weren't just a guy who grew up in a family, in a household with an entrepreneur and were picking this stuff up. You actually built a successful company yourself before this Airbnb for food. The freelance business that you launched, how big did it get?
Yeah. So I went out freelancing. My wife got pregnant. We moved to Virginia. I had to quit my job in Miami. So we moved up here. And I started just moonlighting, you know, or I started moonlighting because I was working remotely. And then I went full-time freelance. And it went really well. And before I knew it, I had a team of 8 subcontractors. We all worked on the same project. And then literally overnight, the investors on that project said, hey, we're not putting any more money into it. So it went back to just me.
And wait, why did you get investors into a freelance business?
It was my clients' investors.
So I see. And so your clients lost their funding. That means you lost your clients. That means you went from a big team of 8 people to just you again.
One client. The good news is they were all contractors, so it's easy enough to kind of part ways. Okay. But then I decided, you know what, I'm going to do it right. I'm going to have an office. I'm going to have employees. And I kind of hit the reset button a few months later, and I had 11 full-time employees, including myself.
Okay.
And had a proper consultancy.
Wow. How did you build up your client list?
Did a lot of referrals. We did a lot of education-based marketing. So we would do seminars. We would do just host a lot of events and kind of get people around us as a company.
Can you give me an example of an event? I have some freelancers or consulting companies who are listening to us here. Mm-hmm. How about a tip or two for how to get clients? Because I know they're listening.
Yeah. So, I mean, we really played the long tail game. What we would do is we would host an event knowing that the majority of the people in the audience are not going to be clients of ours. That wasn't the goal.
What kind of event?
We would do things on like how to do internet marketing or how to hire a software company or, you know, does your app need a iPhone or Android app and what's the difference? You know, a lot of these more just the whys, like the informational seminars. I actually got this from, I was at a, you know, I'm on a few different meetup groups, and one of the local entrepreneur groups sent me an email about, hey, we have this copyright attorney coming in to talk about everything related to, you know, DMCA and all these different like online legal things, which I knew nothing about. And I'm like, whatever, I'll go. There's networking. It's, you know, it could help me get new business and I'll learn a little bit about copyright. And what ended up happening was I learned a lot from the presenter. And I never had a need to hire her, but I referred a lot of my clients to her. So I realized the same thing could probably play true in what I was doing. So we did a lot of these events and people would attend. And a lot of the people attending weren't ever end clients, but they were referral sources. And they got us. I mean, we did work for Mitt Romney. We did work for PETA. We did work for companies, you know, all over the world, all over the country. Not because we had any direct connection to them, but because we increased our surface area of luck.
I see.
So much that we had all these referral sources.
How did you get people to come into the audience and watch you talk about how to hire an agency?
So we would just, at first it was harder because we didn't have an audience of our own. What we would do is we'd go to the Chamber of Commerce and say, hey, can we present to your members? Or we'd go to the local like groups like BNI who'd done the hard work of building up that list. We just siphoned off their audience.
I used to go to BNI meetings out of curiosity. BNI meetings are meetings that meet, I think, once a week or a couple of times a month. And there's a lawyer, a real estate broker, a chiropractor, etc. And the whole goal of the meeting is for them to share referrals. So the lawyer might say, I have someone here who I work with who told me he has a bad back. I'm going to give a referral to the chiropractor. The chiropractor says, the guy who has a bad back who came into my office last week needs a lawyer because he got hurt by a car. The lawyer then takes that referral. And so you would go and speak to these groups. They tend to be amateurs at internet. They are. And so what you're telling me is they weren't the perfect clients for you, but by spreading yourself out among all these people, one of their friends, one of their business contacts became your client. Okay. Exactly. How big did you get the agency? How much revenue are we talking about here?
We did the last year. We did, I think, close to $2 million. Our payroll was $100K a month. So, I mean, the margins weren't huge, but I mean, payroll was our biggest expense. So we were doing about $2 million a year.
So why even bother with software like the software we're going to be talking about, PlanScope, with the course that you taught about how to hire agencies and so on? Why bother with that? It seems like you have a winner.
So we had a big payroll. All of our projects were transactional. We had no recurring revenue. I'd wake up and think, I need to bring in 100K this month. How am I going to do that? It got easier. I mean, we worked a lot on our sales pipeline, but it was still a lot of pressure. I mean, it was still a lot of mouths to feed and money to have coming in into the business each month. And I was looking around. I saw people selling products online with SaaS businesses and subscription revenue. And they didn't seem to have the same pressure that I had running my team. And I knew as a, you know, as somebody who built these things for other people professionally, I had all the resources I needed to build it myself. I just wasn't doing it for myself. I was doing it for other people.
I see. All right. And that tends to be the reason why consultants end up building products. Yeah. And so is it at that point that you started to build out products that you thought would be cool?
It was during that. I mean, I built a few different things that all kind of flopped throughout my career, I guess, as a consultant.
I see. Yeah. How about another idea, another cool idea that didn't work out the way you expected?
Yeah. So I thought, you know, I had a friend who grew orchids, and I thought maybe I'll do some like out of the box orchid distributor website thingy, right? And because, I mean, these people were selling them for a good amount of money. There wasn't anything in space. But what I realized is I have no way of finding orchid people. Like, how do I don't know how to find these people. I know one person.
I see.
And it just, you know, that was kind of the typical thing is there was a disconnect between me being able to find these people, me knowing, is this something they'll pay for? Like, I always thought, like, I think a lot of engineers think, like, this is an obvious need. Let's build it. But we don't actually think, is this something... Now, everyone tries to sell to restaurants and doctors and everything else, but we don't always realize that they don't always see that they have a problem. Like, they don't always see that these aren't people who buy software, maybe. So it's an uphill battle, and I see a lot of people who fail doing that.
You and I are talking about how coming up with a cool idea led to failure for you. Anyone who goes through the Mixergy archives will hear that story over and over and over again, with a few exceptions. But the vast majority of companies that are started by people who just think, hey, this is a really cool idea, someone should build this, I'll go ahead and do it, tend to just bomb. So we still see that they bomb, and we still will continue. People listening to us will still continue coming up with an Airbnb for smoothies or an Airbnb for something else. Why do you think we as entrepreneurs tend to keep making this one mistake over and over and over again?
I think it's really easy, first of all, to build one of these. You know, it doesn't take, nothing stopping you. If you have a computer and knowledge on how to code, you can do it. But on top of that, I just think a lot of people, the ultimate test is money. Like, if somebody will pay for it, if this is a problem that's costing somebody money, that if they fix this problem, they make more money or lose less money. That's the big, like, that's the formula that if you can find something that works around that, that's typically like key to success, at least in the B2B space. And I think, you know, we all want the flashy, vastly scalable whatevers, but we don't realize that it's not just about building an app. The app is the one, or the product itself is just one part of the equation. It's not, you know, it's not the full thing.
I find when I get into those places too, it's creative and fun, and I can't wait for this to be out in the world the way I imagined it in my head, and so that's why I continue. And the other thing is that I don't realize that I'm doing it. I think I'm making a sound business decision. I have enough experience to decide where to go. I have enough understanding to just build it out. I'll just sit and I'll build it, and if I explain it to you, I'm not as good at explaining as I am as showing you. So why bother explaining it to you or a potential customer or anyone else? I'll just do it. Yep. Does that seem like like it's your experience too?
Oh yeah, people. You know, you go into stealth mode. You keep it to yourself. Maybe you ask some friends, and you know, my mom telling me it's a great idea, or my friends telling me it's a great idea. That doesn't mean anything. I need people who say, "I will pay you money for that," to tell me that, and to actually give me a check
before you even build it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan now of pre-sales. I never was in the past. But
I'm going to come back and ask you about how you pre-sold, because I want to see this process and I want to introduce it to the audience. And part of this whole new attitude came to you from Amy Hoy. I mm-hmm. love Amy yes. Hoy. Her yeah. understanding of how to build a business is one of the most solid understandings, one of the most responsible ways of teaching how to build a business, especially for developers. Does she even work with non-developers?
You get the occasional non-developer who goes through her class, but for the most part, you need to be capable of kind of self-doing anything you do.
Coding it up. And I think part of the reason why I respect her approach and why she has such a strong approach is she is a developer herself, and so she doesn't think in BS. She thinks in structure and code and solid understanding of if I do this in a wacky way, it's just not going to work. All right, so you took her course. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from her?
I think what I learned from her is that you want basically what I just mentioned about how you want to find a problem that people have that is costing them money. You know, it's not making them as profitable as they could be. So that's naturally going to mean you're going to be selling to businesses because consumers have a really hard time understanding the value of anything, right? Like I get this myself. Like if I'm buying email marketing software, I'm willing to spend thousands on that, but then I'll go downstairs and refuse to pay 99 cents for an iPhone app.
Yep. Like I know what you mean.
Different mental switch, yep. right? So, you know, when you can focus on businesses and you can look at what problems do they have, more importantly, what problems are they talking about? You know, what are things that I found when I was building PlanScope, I would go Google, like, why does Basecamp suck? You know, what are people complaining about? Why is it?
You would go and Google Basecamp sucks to see why mm-hmm. people said that another project management, Basecamp, didn't work for them. And then you understood what from that?
I would learn, well, you know, maybe it's too general purpose. Maybe it doesn't take into account time and money, which as a consultant, those are like the two constraints that you're always fighting with, or the three constraints, time, money, and scope. And I started to learn really about what are the common things that people keep talking about. I would go into forums, I would go to Reddit threads, Hacker News discussions, all these different places and see, kind of just be a fly on the wall and see like, what are people complaining about? Like what is making people's lives as consultants miserable?
I see. Respond to that. And if they're so pained by it that they're willing to post on Hacker News, on other sites, and complain about it, then it means that they have a need deep enough that they'd be willing to pay to make go away. That's what you were looking for.
Yeah, I mean, if you can tell that it directly affects their bottom line, that to me is like who wouldn't spend a dollar to make 10, right? So,
but Brendan, I understand that once you have this idea for project management that will be different than the software that already exists and different mm-hmm. from the market leaders, that going online and understanding people's complaints would help you sharpen that product, will help you understand how to differentiate it. The question I have is, why project management? What did you do that led you to understand that project management is software that needs to exist in the world and that people are willing to pay for that existence?
So the first thing, it's a proven market, right? Like there's so many project management apps that it's a problem that a lot of people have, right? Like there's a million different solutions for it. But what that means to me, at least, is that there's so many different workflows and needs that as long as I could just find my little niche in all of that and focus on that and don't just compete with the feature sets of everyone else, respond to the problems that I'm getting and respond to them clearly. That was my driving force. My constraints were, is this something that I'm just copying from somebody else? Or is this something that is actually a direct response to something that somebody said, hey, this is a problem I have, or this is a problem that is keeping me from being the best consultant I can be.
Wait, so, Brendan, what you're saying is that this came to you at the original seed of the idea came to you because you said there's so many other programs in this space already?
Yeah, and I mean, I, as a consultant running a team, I tried most of them, right? Like, I knew that, I mean, a lot of it was from that kind of passive harvesting of pain points online. But a lot of it, frankly, was myself. It was problems that I had running my team. It was problems that I knew a lot of other agency owners, and they were having the same issues.
Seed came from you saying, I'm not happy with the software that already exists. The validation and the depth of understanding came from trolling sites and seeing what are people complaining about. Does that seem right to you?
That does. I think it's risky to say if I have the problem, then other people have that same problem. It's a good indicator, but you really want to confirm that, I think, before you really say, this is a big problem for me. I wish there was Airbnb for food. But until you discover that there's other people that have that problem and it's affecting them, the way it's affecting you. I think it's risky to just rely on your own intuition.
Okay, so if I were to make a set of steps, or write a set of steps here in response to this interview, the first mm-hmm. step is to find a pain anywhere. It could be your personal pain, and in your case it was, or maybe it's something that you overheard, or maybe it's something that you've learned by watching someone else, but you find that original pain, and then you start to validate it by looking online to see if anyone else had a similar pain, and keep increasing your depth of understanding by being aware of what kind of pain they're having. What are they complaining about? Is it that the software is too bulky? Is it that it has too many features? Is it that it doesn't have enough features? Is there one feature specifically that it's missing? Mm-hmm. In your case, you found that the one of the big ones was project management needs to also take into account that the people doing the work in that project have to get paid by the hour.
Exactly. That's or have money concerns. Yeah. Okay. And I mean, that's exactly it. Yeah.
But there's still even more. Because you told me about pre-selling. Did you start pre-selling PlanScope?
I didn't. I did build up a list immediately. So before I'd written a line of code, I put up a splash page, a landing page that would basically harvest email addresses. I would promote that to my network, which at the time was pretty small. But what I started to do is I started blogging responses to these pain points that were coming up in forums and on Hacker News and everything. And what I would do is I would basically respond, to comments on my blog. And then I would link to the permalink of that response and that blog post of mine, in the forum or wherever I was, you know. So I would say, mm-hmm. Hey, so you're talking about this issue. I actually have some thoughts from running my agency on scope creep. Here's a link to a blog post I recently wrote on this. And that kind of moved people over to my blog, which then had call to actions for opting in to hear more about PlanScope. So I built up a list of about 300 people doing, totally not scalable. I don't do that anymore, but at first it worked.
Forgive me, but I'm not understanding how you do this. So if you would blog, you'd see someone complain online, yep. Then you would blog about it on your company or personal site?
The PlanScope blog, the new PlanScope.
The PlanScope blog, which yep. existed before the site launch. So you'd blog the answer and then you'd go back to the forum or Hacker News or whatever and you'd yep. say, I wrote an answer to this. Here's a link to the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it a little. I wouldn't just post a link, right? Like, it wouldn't just be a link. It would be once I saw that a lot of people, that this was something that people cared about, that was a signal to me that maybe this deserves a more well thought out response than a comment, right? On a message board. So I would write that, and then I would use that as kind of ammo whenever this question would come up again and again and again, which it would inevitably.
What's an example of a question that you can answer with a blog post? I would think that the answer needs to be, I will build this software, go buy it.
No. So it could be, how do you communicate with, what happens when your client at the 11th hour wants to add more stuff and they don't realize that it's going to cost them more? Gotcha. So it was more informational. It was more, it wasn't about like tools or anything to do that. It was more to kind of build up that kind of authority around me knowing a lot about what it takes to work with clients.
Okay.
And then the response to all of that was, well, I built a tool that is in line with this philosophy that you've been reading about. And when I had the sales page up for, or not the sales page, but the opt-in page for PlanScope, there was no screenshots. There was nothing about software or features. I was throwing the words that people literally were using again and again and again right back at them. And I would throw the pain right in front of them and say, if this is something that affects you also, you're going to want to hear about this product that I'm building.
I see. Gotcha. Answer their issue by teaching something and then saying, I'm building software that does this. I'm looking at an early version of your site, and I see a few different payment structures. Freelancer, which is for one developer, costs $12 a month. A small team, up to 3 developers, $24 a month, and so on. Was that up on the site right from the start?
Once I knew what the tiers would be, yes. At first, no. Because you want to make it obvious that this is a paid product. You know, even if you don't have the product to be paid for yet, you know, you want to at least signal that.
That you're going to be charging, even before mm-hmm. you know what the product is. Okay. And so this landing page was built before the software was even built. You were collecting email addresses of potential customers, yep. 300 customers. Was that enough proof that there was a business around here? Or in retrospect, was that not enough?
I think it was, because one of the differences that I did, which I don't see nearly enough people doing, what ends up happening a lot is you have this like coming soon page for a product and you put in your email and you don't hear anything from them until it's released. And yep. when it is released, you're like, who are the, I don't even remember who these people are. I made it a point to email these people constantly and ask them, here's what I'm thinking. Is this a problem that you have? And what do you think about my way of responding to this problem? So I got people really excited. I really built up that excitement and learned a lot in the process. So I definitely think in terms of learning about, is this really a problem? Am I solving it the right way? By having this scale really help you.
Okay. Let me do a quick sponsorship message here, and then I want to ask you about how long it took you to actually act on all this feedback you were getting and whether it drove you nuts to get so much feedback. First, I have to say thank you to my sponsor, Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. When you're building a business, you need a lawyer who understands the issues that you as an entrepreneur face. And that lawyer is Scott Edward Walker of WalkerCorporateLaw.com. Brendan, do you have any advice for entrepreneurs about how to protect themselves legally, what kind of lawyer to get, or any legal advice? Instead of me doing a plug, we'll ask you for that.
So I think there's consulting legal advice, which is you should always – I still talk to people to this day who don't use an attorney, don't have a contract. They don't have – they just do it all on a handshake. Worst idea you can do. You know, you definitely want to have a lawyer look over your contract, get it airtight. For software – unfortunately, I use my same lawyer for that. I really didn't change anything.
But isn't it expensive to go to a lawyer and say, I just got a client for $10,000. I need you to put together a contract for me to make sure that I'm protected. And then you know your lawyer is going to go overboard with all kinds of stuff that yeah. then your client is going to read and go, I'm taking a risk on you here. And now you're giving me this crazy long contract that makes sure that everything is protected. But now I have to go back to my lawyer and hire a lawyer to read this contract, you know, and then that's going to cost me another $1,000. So basically I'm paying you $11,000. You know what I'm talking about? Doesn't it get to be too much?
Yeah, so my first contract that I hired and that I got created for me when I started my consultancy paid $15,000. I had no idea what I was doing. I paid $15,000 for a contract for what looked like boilerplate copy, right? What I would do these days is there's a lot of really good templates, but don't use use the template, but get it signed off. Like pay your attorney a few hours to actually tweak it for you.
Got it.
It's much better.
Get a template. Take it to your lawyer. Say, "Here's what I want to hand out. Is this okay?" Boom.
Make it local, friendly, and everything else for me. Much better than doing it from scratch.
All right. If you need a lawyer to look over your agreements, to help you set up your company right, to make sure that when it comes time for you to raise money, to buy a company, to sell your company, to hire employees and give them shares in your business, and all that stuff. You want a lawyer who understands it, who's done it many times before, who's in the space, who's working with the kinds of lawyers that are probably going to sue you or probably going to come and work out an acquisition agreement with you. You want a lawyer who has all that experience. That man is Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. Look here, let me give you the URL. I'm not going to tell you nearly enough about him. You're going to want to go and do your own research. Here's the URL that you should go look up. WalkerCorporateLaw.com. WalkerCorporateLaw.com. Brendan, when you get 300 pieces of feedback from people, it could freaking drive you nuts. If I were to open myself up to feedback here, I guarantee you I have a very techie audience. They would say, Brendan should have been in 3D. You know, and I go, all right, Brendan should be in 3D. And someone else should say, no, Brendan should be no video because video is too tough and it's taking up bandwidth, only audio. And then someone else will say, why is the lighting bad? Why don't you bring them into, you know what I'm talking about? It goes crazy. You don't even know where to go. So when you have all these people who are counting on you to build your software and you have 300 potential feedback opportunities, how do you keep it all straight?
You look for consensus. You normalize it all. You look for common themes and you basically disregard the outliers. That's what I did. Bloat is a big problem in software. So I had to be very laser focused on solving that problem. Mm-hmm. And I had to see that people were agreeing with this problem, and here's their feedback for how to solve it, and look for patterns.
Okay, what's a pattern that you noticed right away?
One pattern I found was transparency with clients. So a lot of clients, the first time they would realize what you were charging was when they got their invoice. And one person said it best, and I actually agreed with this. They were like, it's kind of like being in a taxi cab where the meter's broken, right? Like, you hate it when you get to your destination, they give you a number. You don't know how, like, are they just pulling it out of thin air? Like, how did they come up with that number? It would be much better if my clients could see, before I issue them a big invoice, why they're spending money or what they're spending money on. So,
got it. Yeah. So now, as they're going through the project management software, interacting with the work that you're doing, making adjustments to the scope of the project that they're hiring you, the freelancer, to do, they also get to see their rate go up and down based on the work that you're doing and the requests that they're making.
Most issues have to do with bad communication. So
gotcha.
I realized the tool just had to facilitate communication. One tool isn't going to fix everything, but it can help.
How long did it take you to do that, to actually launch the first version after all this feedback?
4 months.
4 months?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was very basic at first. It only had to solve that one problem. I wasn't looking to make it so it worked with every possible need.
Why? I understand why you wouldn't want to wait a year, but why 4 months as opposed to maybe 1 month and launch it faster?
I was running a company, so I had to. I didn't have a lot of time.
Okay. In the meantime, do I understand that you were also doing courses?
I did courses later.
Later. Okay. So this was the project that you were focused on. You finally launch it to this audience of people. How did it do?
It didn't pay the bills for a while. I mean, with SaaS or any subscription revenue, it's hard because, you know, when you're making $200 a month off of it and your growth rate is 10 or 20%, okay, you're going to make $240 next month and then, you know, $300 maybe the next month. It's slow growth. My goal was to make this more of a living, like something I could live off of, not, you know, I now look at these things as really well-performing assets, like an investment, right? But before, I was looking at it as an income replacer, and it took a while.
Were you shocked when you launched it and you only got a few $100 worth of orders as opposed to the thousands that you needed in order to survive?
In retrospect, I shouldn't have been, but you know, you always think that you're going to have hit hockey stick and, you know, it'll be making thousands and thousands a month and then you're set. No, it didn't.
I see.
It took time.
How did you even know then that it was the right product? I mean, 4 months of work, you launch it to people who you should see get excited about it, to people who are representing a bigger community that should have been even more excited about it because they were complaining online, they were talking about it in forums, you were nursing them and understanding them and so on, and you still only got hundreds of dollars. How did you know that it was a potentially good idea and not say, hey, you know what, people aren't really willing to pay for this. They're happy with Basecamp.
Well, because the people paying for it were very happily paying for it. They were more successful as a result. I just had an issue with reach. It was a reach issue. It was getting more of those people, finding more of them.
I see. So you're saying, I have a small audience, so it makes sense that I would have a small customer base. If I could just grow that audience from 300 to 3,000 to 30,000, et cetera, then I could have a good percentage of them sign up, and I know that they'll be happy because if this first version made my small group happy, the next version will make the bigger group happy.
That's exactly what I
got
next.
All right, but you still need to bring in some money. And so is this why I'm looking at a collection of websites here, like Freelancers Guild, like a Skillshare course, like Consultancy Masterclass and the rest? Is that what you did to keep yourself going while you were waiting for PlanScope to work?
Yeah. The really interesting thing about running PlanScope was I started getting customer feedback and support tickets that had nothing to do with the product. They were about, hey, you run an agency, can you give me tips on pricing? And I kept getting a lot of this. And I realized, you know, I had a lot of these email conversations back and forth on pricing and like, how do I charge more? And I was like, you know, I'm so stuck up, I guess, when it comes to software being the only way. But at the end of the day, everyone just wants a better business. And that could be through a book, it could be through software, it could be through a video course, it could be through one-on-one coaching. I mean, there are many different mediums that will get them there.
So what's the first thing that you did then of all of these?
First thing I did was a book called Double Your Freelancing Rate, which is actually to this day, my most successful product.
How can people see that book?
DoubleYourFreelancingRate.com.
Okay. Double Your Freelancing Rate. You sold it for $50.
$50.
How did you come up with that price? I would think the books are supposed to sell for $5 if they're online, $20 if they're hard copy. You know, where'd you come up with $50?
So I there is kind of a stigma attached to a book and what you can charge. Like, you can't charge 500 easily for an ebook. A lot of people these days are actually able to sell 50, $90 ebooks. What made me do it was I realized that if this book is successful, if somebody can raise their rate by even a dollar an hour, it'll pay for itself in a few hours, really. So I really anchored that price against that upside. And I really focused on what will tomorrow look like? What will it mean for you and your family if you can add $10 an hour to your rate, right? Like, what does that mean? And it became, Jane Austen novels aren't going to make you more money, but a book that teaches you how to, there's all these things. Like, now I'm positioning it as a course because it is actually more of like a course instead of just an ebook. People are fine paying $50 to $500 to $5,000 for a course, but as a book, it's a little, that kind of stuff.
I'm on doubleyourfreelancingrate.com right now. And at the very top of the page, I see a calculator. Put in your price per hour and how many hours you work, and then you'll see how much money increasing it will put in your pocket. And I scroll down the page and scroll down the page and scroll down the page again, and says, if you're billing $50 an hour, the book will pay for itself in less than an hour at your new rate, and so on. Did you, as a freelancer, as a developer, as someone in the Hacker News community, say, I can't put this out there. This is a long form sales letter. It's a little cheesy. I'm offering people to get them rich. What am I doing here?
It was hard. It was, as a developer, it was very hard because these scream kind of info marketer to me, right? The format, it reminded me of the direct marketing my dad was doing. And, but at the end of the day, what makes me so excited about these products and makes me keep doing them are the like hundreds of tagged emails in Gmail that are saying, you let me go on my honeymoon because I finally figured out what was keeping me back. And if I wasn't getting results, I would have not been doing it or stopped doing it. But I realized, information is a very, it's all about building that better business. A software tool can help them do that. But it's actually a little quicker usually for an info product. They buy the book, they get the info, they charge more on their next proposal, they win it. Now I could have helped them make a lot more money pretty quickly. Like, the feedback loop is pretty small.
I'm on the page, as I said earlier, and at the very bottom it says, Brennan Dunn is the founder of We Are Titans, and that links over to wearetitans.net. Mm-hmm. You are still running your agency.
I was when I launched PlanScope, yes.
Okay. But now, as I link over to it, it says, wearetitans.net says, we're helping build a better web. Contact us today. Is that still running?
It is, but I've converted everyone to independent contractors. Most of them are freelancers, most of my former employees. And I still get leads, and I just, we occasionally will farm them out and say, does anyone need a project?
So if I were to click over to it, I'm not going to get Brennan working on my project or project managing it, but I will get someone who Brennan recommends to run my project. Right. Do you still make money off of those referrals?
It's really trickled down. Within the first year, yes, but there's no effort being put into the consultancy anymore. Now I'm fully focused on this.
Did you pre-sell the book?
I did.
You did? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whoa. All right. So everyone says pre-sell the book. I understand the logic of it, because if you're pre-selling it and you make enough money, then you have a sense that there will be money if you finish writing this book. Great. There is money in the bank even, which is encouraging. The thing that I found, though, in talking to people who listen to my interviews and hear other entrepreneurs say pre-sell, is they'll go and pre-sell. They'll be shocked that money comes in the bank. They'll be excited that they're actually getting people to pay ahead of time and start to dream of how much more money they'll make when the actual product is out there for more customers to buy. And then they're going to feel overwhelmed. Oh my God, I have to write this book. And there's a gun pointing at my head. Essentially, all these people are waiting. And if I don't get it right, they're going to not shoot me, but they're going to be upset. What do you do with that much pressure?
So what I did is, the last thing I wanted to do was take people's money and disappear and say, I'll be back in a few weeks or a few months. I just started writing them weekly and saying, here's what I've been writing. I'd love your feedback on it. You're basically getting early access. I wouldn't copy and paste whole chapters, but it would be kind of summaries. And I just made it a point to email each week. And what's funny is, once I launched the book, I could go two ways. I could say, all right, I've done my job. The book's out. I don't need an email every week. But instead, I made it my weekly newsletter, which has been by far the number one catalyst for my business as a result.
So because of the newsletter, you're able to reach an audience of people who can buy the other things that you put together.
Exactly.
Got it. I know how many books you sold. I know how much revenue you made from it because we have a researching team here, research staff. And actually, frankly, you told one of them. You told April what your revenue was. Why aren't you, you know, more protective of this revenue? I'm looking here at a very detailed revenue breakdown.
Well, I mean, it's not as easy as copying and pasting, right? Like there's a lot of, I'm not afraid to share because I don't see it hurting me in any way.
What about this? It may not physically hurt you, but we're all kind of, I don't know how to say this. We're all comparing ourselves. We're all judging other people, right? If you are a guy who has $50,000 a year, we judge you. People judge you. If you have $100,000 a year, we judge you. If there is no number, we can't judge you based on a number, and you've taken away something that will allow someone to say, Brennan is not that successful, or make people say, Brennan is so successful, why isn't he buying drinks? You know, isn't there like a judgment issue there?
Possibly, but I think the only reason I'm here at all doing this is I looked at income reports from Patrick McKenzie. I was looking at what Amy Hoy was doing back in the day. And that made me realize, I mean, they weren't always huge numbers. Even to this day, I'm not doing millions a year or anywhere near that. But it allows, what I found is it inspires that kind of next generation. Like I'm a newer generation, I guess, of people who are starting into this online business thing. And I know for a fact it's inspired people to say, you know what, I can do this. It's doable. Like these aren't far off numbers. These are things like, here's a systematic formula I can use. I've seen some people try to knock off what I'm doing, but for the most part, it's people taking what they're great at, what they're really good at, and applying what me and a lot of other people have done and shared publicly in their own business.
Tell me if I come across as a scummy person for saying this, but I believe we have both an external motivator and an internal motivator. Yes, the external one is I want to, or in your case, you want to take care of other people and you want to teach them because you want to pay it forward. The internal motivation, though, is the more you publish your numbers, the more freelancers get interested in it, the more they believe that what you're doing actually is real and others are buying, so it creates social proof, the more they're drawn to keep checking out your site and then maybe buy your book, maybe sign up for PlanScope, maybe sign up for one of your other products. True?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had people who have entered my funnel through looking at an income report that made it to Hacker News.
I'm looking at where your traffic's coming from, and one of the top sources of traffic for which domain am I looking at? I'm looking at planscope.io. WooThemes is sending you traffic. I got to ask you about that in a moment, but Hacker News is sending you traffic. I noticed that. So then what I did was I went to look at Google. I did a site search on Hacker News for planscope.io, and then I came up with a little over 2,700 a month from PlanScope. So you're sharing your numbers there. Then I see that you share your numbers in another post. Then you do an Ask HN, freelancers seeking freelancer help. So it does help you get traffic. It does help you connect with this community. You're even in Hacker News, I see, posting your email address, for example. Email me. I have a few customers testing out my soon-to-be public API. Would love to get, there it is. And you actually put your email address in there.
Yeah.
All right. How much did you make from selling the book?
Selling which book?
Double your rate. Double your freelancing rate.
I think they're both actually, in 2013, I think it was
40. You know, actually, I have the numbers here.
It's all right there. I know the total that I brought product-wise in last year, which is 324, I think.
$324,000 came from products.
Yeah.
Okay. And part of that is double your freelancing rate. In 2013, that book brought in $24,721. You get down to the dollar.
And that's with zero. There was no ongoing marketing at all.
The page just survives. If I were to go to archive.org and compare two months worth of pages, it would look exactly the same. Go back and back and back. It would look essentially the same.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. That's double your freelancing rate. If I were to look at, let me see what April put together for me in the research, PlanScope, 2013 revenue. Actually, no, let's talk about 2012 revenue. First year the thing is up and running, right? That's 2012 is the first year?
February 2012.
February 2012, you launch it. it gets customers, how much revenue do you bring in? Sorry, the connection seems to have gone away. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. You cut out for a second.
Yeah, so how much revenue?
In 2012?
Yeah. Actually, you tell me if you want me to read it. I often ask questions that I know the answers to.
I don't remember 2012. I remember 2013.
Okay, I'll give you 2012 is $29,904, right?
The
first year in business doesn't seem like a huge amount, especially for a guy who was running a multi-million dollar consulting company. But you're saying it's the feedback that you were getting that kept you going. 2012, do you remember that number?
Or 2013? Yeah. Actually, last 2013. Year, I think, was 80-ish, I think, if I remember.
Yeah, $87,726.
Still not what I was making consulting, anywhere close to it. So,
is it hard sometimes to go from running a company that's doing millions of dollars to suddenly running a book that's doing thousands of dollars and another project for thousands and so on?
No, because it's not really – like when I was running the company, I was traveling a lot. I missed out on a lot of my kids growing up, art shows, concerts, school events. I was at our office downtown 9 to 6 daily. I would come home, maybe get 30 minutes to hang out with my kids before they went to bed. Nowadays, I work from home. I'm lucky to work maybe 20 hours a week. Total lifestyle change. And it's, you know, even though it's not as, I mean, I actually think it's more glamorous in a way. I'm not jet setting all over, but, you know, I'm happier and I am influencing more people than the handful of clients I had.
I noticed that actually, that you're happy and relaxed. I always talk to guests before we get started, and often it's to relax them because there's so much stress around them. And then I barge into their offices right on their computer, which is the stress box in the middle of their day, and I want to chat with them, and they just want to get back to whatever's causing problems. You weren't like that. We were chatting. We were chatting about family. We were chatting about kids. We were chatting about all kinds of stuff, and I get that. And I see that there's a satisfaction and happiness there that all these numbers that I dig in my interviews can't really communicate. Let's take a look at one other thing here in this list. Again, I have all of the revenue here in front of me. Thank you, April. There it is. Something called Consultancy Masterclass brought in $80,557 in 2013. What is that?
That is a two-day workshop that I do. It's kind of the end of my funnel, really. It's people who bought that generally buy my other books. What happens is they pay $50 for my book, make a lot of money in return, and then they want to take it to the next level. So it's an $1,800 course. It's pricey. It's the priciest thing I offer. And what it is it's two days of just really in-depth teaching plus group coaching. So one of the things I discovered is when you write an ebook or have a book, it's like a one-to-many broadcast, right? Like you're able to read the author, but there's no dialogue. You can't – what's the protocol to like ask a question, right? So I realized that there's a lot of people who want to go even more in depth and say, let's talk about me and my situation, and I want to talk to Brennan about that. So it's a way, it's kind of my group coaching, but packaged as a product. And it's a two-day, 5-hour day event facilitated over Google Hangouts. And I've had about 120-ish people go through it. And it's small. I mean, it only counts for maybe 2% of my customer base, but it's, I think, almost half, or not almost half, but more than a quarter of my revenue. So it's again, it's closer to the metal. It's closer to when you read a book, it's, you know, it's more general. It needs to be more general. But when you get that kind of like individual coaching or group coaching, then you can really dive into specifics. So it's kind of, my funnel is laid out like that, where the more expensive the product, the more Brennan involvement there is, I guess, is a way to put it.
Looking where traffic is coming to from there, and it's all within the Brennan empire.
Yeah, that there's page I don't advertise it.
No, I mean, and frankly, people aren't talking about it, and you're not posting it on Hacker News or anything. It's maybe you are, but I don't see it. But yep. BrennanDunn.com sends a lot of traffic. Planscope.io, again, the site that we've been talking about, sends it traffic. DoubleYourFreelancingRate.com sends it traffic. Skillshare.com, where you teach, sends it traffic. And Petovera, run by our mutual friend Matt, sends it traffic. Yeah. So this is the top of your funnel, meaning people will have gone through your other sites before they come here to buy.
The funny thing is, all those referrers you mentioned don't send to customers. What sends to customers are my emails.
This is where I want to get into. You are very good at doing database marketing. Database marketing means what?
I don't call it that. I call it marketing automation. But basically, the idea being you have customers, right? And these customers have attributes. And there are automated ways of kind of gluing everything together where you can say, once somebody's bought my first book, Double Your Freelancing Rate, which is really my entry-level product, I want to then move them on to, if they're successful with that, I want to move them up, you know, further down the funnel. And I have all these automated ways that glue it all together. So you're going to get promoted my masterclass automatically once you've done enough stuff with me. So that's primarily how I run my entire business off of so little input time.
I see. You use probably Infusionsoft, my guess is, right? Yeah. Okay. So a customer comes in, Infusionsoft emails them. If they buy something, then it puts them into a second sequence, which allows them to learn about the next product, which then gives them another sequence and so on. I would not, as a stranger, go to consultancy masterclass and give you my email address and then end up at the end.
I could dump $1 million in AdWords campaigns for that sales page, it would convert no one, because no one is, you can't, the jump from no relationship, zero cash flow to 1800 is a very big jump. So that's why it's a long-term thing. And these are people who have been in my database for 6+ months. I've been engaging with them over time, but it's done at scale. Most of it's automated.
Let me see. I want to make sure that I've got everything here before I ask you a personal question. We talked about pre-selling, which I wrote down earlier when we mentioned, and I promised I'd get back into. We talked about re-releasing your book. By the time this post is up, there will be a re-release. What's different about the re-release?
The difference is 2 years of production data of the book. So I've learned a lot. In 2 years of having this book out, people ask me questions about, well, can you dive deeper into this? You know, can you clarify this? How do I raise rates with existing clients? And I've added about 50+ pages of new content. But I'm also doing, and this is... I'm packaging it. So I have two tiers now. The higher tier is going to have over 15 hours of video interviews that I've done with people who have read the book and implemented it. And I'm asking them, so what were the big challenges? And, you know, you're a web designer from Scotland. Like, what was the issue that kept you from raising your rates? Like, what specific about you? So it's a way, you know, you pay more and you get all this extra video content of people who you can probably relate to a little better, right? So... those are the two tiers I'm offering, and it's first time I haven't touched the book or the sales page in 2 years. The sales page you just pulled up is the new sales page, but before that it was dated.
It looks sweet. I see the collection of quotes on the right margin, which looks really nice.
And what's working well about that page is instead of just testimonials, I have percentage differences.
Yes.
So next to each one, you see they raised their rate by, you know, 400%, even 20%. You know, as long as it's. And you can kind of correlate that to that calculator on the left and be like, oh, well, imagine if I raise my rate 50%. What would that mean for my business, right?
I see it. No, this is a really nicely done sales page.
Thank you.
All right. We got to copy some of that. what else do I have in my notes before I ask you a personal question about me, actually? I would like your advice about me, because every time someone interviews me about interviewing, they talk about my past business and it's interesting and blah, blah, blah. And they talk about Mixergy and it's interesting, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end they go, by the way, I have this question. And that becomes fascinating, because at the end they say, here's the thing that I really am struggling with. And it becomes much more of a real question and much more useful. So two more things. I want to thank Rob Walling for introducing me to you. Rob, actually not introduced. I've known you for a while. I don't know. I've known your story. I've seen you online.
We met when you lived in DC. You had a little dinner at some like Thai restaurant. Starting out,
I don't remember. I know the Thai restaurant in what's it called in Chinatown.
Yeah, it was like a Grub With Us dinner or some one of those things, right?
So here's the thing: I've seen your stuff online. I've known you for a while. It took Rob Walling to go, dude, here's someone you should have on the site, and you know that makes me wonder why I'm not more on top of it, and I should have suggested, I should have known to ask you. But it also makes me wonder why you never said, hey, you know what, Andrew? Here's a story. Or did you and I missed it?
No, I'm really bad at kind of cold outreach like that. That's a flaw of mine. I'm doing joint ventures now where I'm reaching out to people that I somewhat know and asking them to help me promote my products. doesn't come naturally to me, just put it that way.
I know, and unfortunately, the people for whom it comes naturally, we have to spend a lot of time saying, you are not a good guest here. And I don't know right. how to, actually, I do know. We have a way of explaining to someone they're not a good guest without telling them that the reason that we're saying no is because they are blinging up their website. It's them and champagne and money thrown all over. And, you know, like, he became a millionaire by the time he was 21, and now he's a multimillionaire and all that bull.
My Facebook feed is full of that crap these days.
I know. And so I have to be nice when I reject them, because frankly, I could be wrong, and I don't want to, you know, ruin a relationship with someone who I quickly just realize is not a good guest. But we have to turn those people down a lot, because those people, sir, are very good at self-promotion, and they will be aggressive and they will cajole.
That's right.
That's what they do. All right. Quick plug for people who want to take this relationship to the next level, who want to learn how to build all this stuff. We have a couple of courses in Mixergy Premium that teach you how to figure out what your customer's pain is, how to then build products based on it, and how to build a successful business around not cool ideas, but understanding people's real problems and satisfying those real problems and then building slowly over time with them. We have both interviews and courses. The cool thing about the courses is you will see step by step by step over a course of an hour the process laid out for you and shown to you how other people do it. The other set of interviews and courses that I recommend to you are those on marketing automation. The reason that I called it database marketing is Daniel Fagella, who taught a course here about how to do it, calls it database marketing. Daniel Fagella talked to me for hours after the interview to show me how to implement it at Mixergy. And now his phrase is stuck in my head. But whether you call it database marketing, which makes sense, or marketing automation or anything else, we have several courses at Mixergy with real entrepreneurs who show you how they do it. They show you their funnels. They show you screenshots step by step of how to do it. One of the cool things about Daniel is he said, look, most people just ask for an email address. After I get the email address, what I do that's different for most people is I start asking a few other questions, like how big is, actually for him, it's what kind of fighting do you like? Because he does sites teaching people martial arts. And so he says, once you get that kind of data, you can really start to talk to people using their language, and you can really start to explain what you have, that you can really introduce them to the products you have that make sense to them, not the ones that you just happen to create. Anyway, those courses are all part of Mixergy Premium. I urge you, if you're an entrepreneur or want to build a business, to go check out mixergypremium.com, sign up. And if it's not right for you, you know what I usually say? Ask for a refund, and of course I'll give you a refund. But what I would like you to do is complain. You will get an email directly from me as soon as you join. I would like you to hit reply and say, Andrew, this stinks, or it's not right for me, or it's not changing my life. And then I will work with you to make it happen. MixergyPremium.com. All right, Brendan, you are great at marketing automation. One of the things that I am working on today and this week is, when someone comes to my site and gives me their email address, I don't just want to throw them into the site, and I don't just want to show them the latest thing that we created, but I want to show them the best course or interview or blog post or whatever for their issue. Right. And so I'm asking them, after they give me their email address, like Daniel suggested, where are you? Do you have a company or not? Are you struggling with traffic? Or are you struggling with selling to people who are already coming to your site? Or is it, and we have a list of issues. Then I start to send them an interview based on what they told me. Mm-hmm. Brendan, what I'm trying to figure out is, how do I know if the interview I'm sending them is hitting the spot? How do I know if it's really helping? Or maybe I'm sending them the wrong interview. Maybe an interview is not the right thing they're looking for. Maybe it's too long. Maybe they're not sure what to listen for. Maybe something else. I've been asking them, but people do not yet respond to my request.
So these are people who just signed up, right? Who've paid you. Is there any way that you can kind of group them in a way that you can figure out churn rate differences between the two? Like,
it's, you know, very early with it. We just created the funnel on Friday, and today you and I are recording on a Tuesday.
Okay.
We put it up, but the cool thing about the Mixergy audience is I already got hundreds of people who just came in, put in their email address, told me where they were in the stage, and we're talking about over a matter of days.
So you have data.
I have data. And so we started sending them, if they said, I need to figure out how to start a new business, I sent them my interview with Joel from BufferApp.com, mm-hmm. where he talked about how he came up with his idea for this business, and he shared his revenue and so on. I sent that to them, and then I sent them an email follow-up saying, so what did you think of that? Did it help or not? And I got no response.
Okay. So a few things you could try. So I'm actually doing something kind of like that, where it's part of my newsletter onboarding, where I ask point blank, do you have an issue with pricing, lead generation, or sustainability? I'm doing that before they pay me anything, though. But what's interesting about doing that, and I could talk for hours about this, I'm getting about a 20% conversion rate within 10 days of anyone who joins my list is buying something from me, which I'm really, really happy about. That's been a work in progress for a while, which opens up the door to paid acquisition pretty quickly. But for what you're doing there, you could try being a little more specific with the question. You could say, like, what's one takeaway that you're going to take from Joel and apply to your business? And that is a little easier, I think, to respond, because they don't need to, you know, they don't need to come up with like a lengthy, like, you know, response or anything. You could start with that and then maybe get a conversation going and talk to them about, so did you, like, was that hour you spent watching that interview, was that worth giving up an hour? Right? Like, okay, was that worth your time?
So ask a more specific question instead of an open-ended question that they could answer anything to.
I do a lot of my newsletters, the call to action is really a respond. Like, I want people to reply. And what I learned is the replies I get, I get more replies when I ask a very specific question. Like asking somebody, what's one big issue? That's so broad, they need to think. They need to be like, well, what is one big issue that I have, like consulting? But when you can say, like, you know, I don't know, I can't think of an example, but something really specific.
Even as specific as, did you get to watch the interview?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, are you using Wistia?
Yes, so we can tell if people have watched it. How about, was it useful?
Yeah, you could, yeah, you, what you want to know is, are they going to make a change in their business as a result? Right? Okay. That's the number one thing you want to know. And I think by getting specific and being like, what's the number one thing you're going to do? You could even get a little more fancy by saying, okay, today's Tuesday, or it's, you know, this week, what are you going to do by Monday, April, whatever, next April, or May 1st, whatever next Monday is? What do you plan on doing by then as a result of what you just heard from Joel? Like, what's one change you're going to make next Monday as a result of this video interview?
I see. And if they're not responding to that, then it means that it's not useful and we try something else.
And you could also, one thing that works, hit them again a few days later saying, hey, never heard from you. I'm really interested in knowing.
Okay.
I would do that.
All right. I like that. And we can actually do that now in software. So if exactly. they don't respond, I come back a couple of days and they see that I'm at least paying attention and know that they didn't respond.
And make sure the email is plain text looking. Can't be formatted and fancy and whatever.
It needs to look like
it came from you.
I don't like even receiving those formatted things. My mind instantly, when I see it looking formatted and nice, says, oh, newsletter, I should unsubscribe.
Computer made that. That's the connection you make in your head.
Right.
The computer generated this email.
I actually now even came up with an easy process for unsubscribing. I use Mailbox, the app on my phone, to check email.
Uh-huh.
And I can move an email that I don't like or I want to unsubscribe from into a folder that I call unsubscribe that automatically emails my virtual assistant that I got from Zirtual and says, can you please unsubscribe me from this? And I do that using Zapier. And she unsubscribes me, and that's it. And that means I don't even have to figure out their unsubscribe process. I don't even have to click it. I'm just in my flow. And if it looks like a newsletter, I unfortunately have to do that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Good idea.
All right. If we were to tell people how to follow up with you, apparently you do Thai dinners in the D.C. area.
Actually not. I'm 3 hours south of D.C., but I'm up there a lot.
Okay, so that's probably not the best way to do it. I actually would urge people to at least check out your site. One of the things that I like about looking at a site that's this thought out is that just by glancing at it, you get to pick something up. Like, I noticed instantly that on the right side you had those quotes and that you had people's rates and how much they increased. I instantly noticed what you were doing with this calculator. So one of the things I like about these well-thought-out sites is there's a lot to learn from them. The other thing I think people should do is, actually, which of your sites should we refer them to? As the site to get to know Brennan.
BrennanDunn.com. I'm actually doing a redo. The design is a little dated, but by the time this is out, it'll be a new design.
All right, let me take a look at the
dated site.
That
has my podcast that has links to all of my different things. So it's a good, and it's a way to get all my newsletter.
All right, it's not too dated, but I see what you mean. I see you even have on the bottom, this site rocks the Thesis Classic skin for Thesis, so you didn't even change the attribution.
That's Deepling Designer.
Sorry?
Fixing that now.
All right. All right. Thank you so much for doing this interview. Everyone else, please, if you got anything of value out of this interview or anything else, not just on Mixergy, but frankly online, thing to do is to find the person and to say thank you. That is the best way to build a relationship. Start by thanking them. And I'm going to do it right here, right now, by thanking you, the audience who's listening, and by thanking my guests. Thank you so much for doing this interview with me.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Bye, everyone.